This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language. The XX GabFest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Podcast for Thursday, December 27th, the Home for the Holidays edition. Merry Christmas to all of you, except for the Jews and the Muslims and the Buddhists and the atheists and everyone else. Merry whatever to you. This is Hannah Rosen, recording from the Washington, D.C. studio, and I am joined today by Allison Benedict, a XX editor in New York. Hi, Allison.
Hi, guys.
And also Noreen Malone from The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
So our three topics today are, one is Nancy Lanza, the mother of Adam Lanza, the shooter in the Newton killing, and the growing world of women gun owners. Second is the new Judd Apatow movie, This is 40. And third is whether the holidays, which you are all actually right now experiencing, are holidays or are a form of family hell, the eternal question that we are all mulling right at this moment. So let's start with our newsy topic, which is Nancy Lanza. With mass shooters who are almost always male, we wonder about the culture of anxious modern masculinity, where boys inherit their father's fixation on violence. But this time in the Newton shooting, there was a twist. It was the shooter's mother, not father, Nancy Lanza, who was the gun nut, who stashed powerful weapons and bragged about them at bars. But Nancy's not an aberration. At a time when more women are living alone and when it's becoming more acceptable for women to be aggressive, more of them are buying and shooting guns. So we're going to talk about that trend now and what it's all about. Is it about self-protection? Is it about empowerment? Is it about bragging rights or sexiness? What's going on here? Allison, I'll start with you. We had what I thought was a great piece in XX by Porochista Kakpour, who is Iranian-American, and was describing her own personal trajectory with gun ownership and what it meant to her and how she changed her mind. So can you talk a little bit about her take on this subject?
It's a really beautiful piece. I encourage everyone to look it up. She basically was 25 and she had gone through a couple of traumatic situations, being date raped, being assaulted by a couple of men, being the victim of some violent muggings. And she tried a bunch of things. She went to therapy. She enrolled in self-defense classes. But eventually she was dating a guy who took her to a shooting range and she says, I think, you know, I held the gun the first time like it was a snapping, yappy puppy, you know, just kind of not wanting to embrace it. But after the first time she shot, she was in love. And she talks at length about how it made her feel sexy and how it made her feel powerful and how all the men that she dated thought it was so cool until she met the one who didn't. And he told her that he would not want to be in a long-term relationship with someone who would have a gun in the home. What if they had children? And she slowly started thinking it through more. But at the same time, she said she still had this passion for guns, for the way that it made her feel powerful. And she still time and again thought about buying one until this recent tragedy. And she talks a bit about how this notion of empowerment is really kind of bullshit. I think the line that she uses is, it's time to realize what much of gun loving actually is, a passion for destruction veiled as protection.
You know, it's funny. I felt like she wasn't as convincing about the empowerment as bullshit as she was about the gun loving as sexy. Like her heart was kind of still in the gun loving as sexy. And in fact, that part of the essay reminded me in Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, you know, in the beginning when she tries to describe what kind of girl every guy wants a girl to be, which is like tough and, you know, kind of sexy tough. In the Angelina Jolie super heroine vein. And a lot of in that essay, the kind of vivid writing was with the guns are sexy and empowering, I thought.
I think that that's what we think that men find attractive. And I think that that, you know, there's obviously an attraction to this archetype in culture now, the tough female action hero. But I'm not convinced that that's actually true.
I also don't think that's what's going on with gun ownership and women in America. I don't think that's why it's on the rise. I think it's more just that there is an urban-rural divide in gun ownership, right? And yes, men still own more guns than women. But in the same way that gender norms in rural, white, working class places are breaking down in ways that you've written about, Hannah, you know, in other spheres, it's not really a surprise that they would break down in this sphere, too, with more women sort of assuming part of the protector role in the really, really traditional sense of the protector role, you know, having the gun to shoot the bad guy.
That is such an interesting point because I didn't get into this in my book, but one of the set of statistics I stumbled on and didn't write about was the way that rural America and deep urban America are statistically converging, you know, so we have this sense of rural America as being this sort of beautiful protected place in which things operate in some nostalgic way. But in fact, it's become the exact opposite and only in the last 9 or 10 years. And so you have, you know, the rates of sort of single motherhood, of women working with small children, of teenage pregnancy, sort of all those rates are exactly the same in very rural America as they are in very urban America.
Is this the Charles Murray set of
arguments? There's a little bit of Charles Murray in there, but you know,
he's not totally wrong. You know,
he's not totally wrong about the statistics. It's just, you know, his analysis is like it's because we have lost our morals. But one thing I thought about reading about Nancy Lanza is, you know, forget the empowerment. It's a way of regaining a sense of control. If you think about Nancy Lanza in 2008, getting this divorce and spending her life basically dealing with an out of control, difficult son. I mean, we can assume who knows if there were signs he was going to shoot up a school. But clearly, the, you know, from the little hints that we have so far, she had to take him out of school and homeschool him. He was a difficult, difficult child. And surely her life felt out of control a lot of the time. And so I wondered if in the same way that it did it for Porchista, if that's how you pronounce her name, that it gives women who are, let's say, living alone, living without men, you know, having lives that are in somewhat disarray. I'm completely going out on a limb here, but a sense of control over their lives.
Well, and there were some reports, it's not clear how substantiated they are, that she was part of the prepper subculture preparing for doomsday. And I think that certainly probably is about maintaining a sense of control in the face of utter fear that it's all over, right?
Do you think that's generally the reason why men also have guns?
I came across a lot of that when I was reporting in Alabama. I didn't particularly write except in a sentence or two about that. But that subculture is very much, it's actually different than, say, the Y2K subculture, which I covered in the Washington Post, that sort of general sense of apocalyptic doom, because it's very closely tied to the economy and the decline of America as a global power. Like when people talk now about why they have their own guns and grow their own food, it has to do with the fact that we are losing our centrality and one day we won't be able to afford to import foods. It's like an economic breakdown argument. And so, yes, I think it probably does have to do with men as well as women.
This is just one subset of gun owners, right? Like plenty of people have it for sport, right? And those aren't the people we're paying attention to in this moment.
Although I think the statistics on women are that for sport, yes, but for hunting, not so much. So for shooting at a shooting range, the percentage of women has gone pretty drastically up. But
right.
I think hunting is still predominantly a male sport.
So I stumbled across an interview with an NRA spokeswoman who said that women do typically tend to get into firearm ownership because of safety reasons, but then they sort of engage with the, you know, recreational targets, shooting and hunting, and that comes second for them, which I thought was interesting. And also, it's really similar to what's going on in politics for the Republican Party. The white male base, which is, you know, who buys their guns, that's eroding. That's becoming less of a percentage of Americans. So they're trying to figure out ways to market guns to new consumers. And women are a huge market for them. So every few years, there's just a real concerted push. You know, we always talk about the princess toys for little girls. They're sort of princess guns. And that's not new. There have been, you know, pearl-handled revolvers, you know, for years and centuries. But
you're right. No, they're actively developing these lighter weapons, smaller weapons. Yeah. I mean, sure, they're like the pink pistols and the purses that hold guns. But even apart from that, they're developing weapons that are made for a woman's hand.
And the really chilling description that was in one of those was that for a woman's hand, it's the same size as like a child's hand. And that was just sort of an upsetting little coincidence.
Right.
I'm curious, Hannah, when we've talked about your book in the past, you talked about that the one place where women have not kind of taken over the male role in the household is as protector. You said, I remember you talking about that women still in the end, when you would ask, like, what does it mean to be the head of household? The wife would say, well, if there was a burglar, my husband would protect me.
It's funny now thinking about gun ownership, I'm starting to think that maybe that's a fantasy. In other words, that's a fantasy that people hold on to and an idea of men that people hold on to, but is not necessarily people's reality. So the reality is that you're a woman who's recently divorced and living alone somewhere, you buy a gun. Even though you have a sense that a man, you know, should or could be your protector, you know, the man is not actually physically living with you in the house most of the time. And so you own your own gun. I mean, this 23% of women own guns was the last Gallup poll. That's really high. A quarter of all American women own guns. That's not live in a house with a gun. That's something like 45%. That's own their own gun. That's really high. And, you know, I'm really glad you guys brought up the marketing aspect of it, because the NRA campaign, I forgot what it's called, but the NRA started targeting women around the year 2000 with these lighter firearms that you talked about. There's an argument in gun control, and Amanda Marcotte wrote a blog post about this for us, about how we should stop focusing on gun owners, like stop making it a fight between, you know, the Americans who think it's their right to own guns and the rest of us, but treat them like smokers, like treat them as victims of an industry that's preying upon them. I haven't fully digested what I think about that argument, but that's one of the ways in which people are thinking about going after gun rights. And so then you sort of turn your attention on the NRA as opposed to the women who own the guns and think, you know, are they kind of creating this new market, reaching out to them? Are they essentially, it's like the equivalent of Virginia Slims or something.
I think that's tough to do because that puts you as the gun owner in the role of victim. You know, you are at the mercy of these larger forces, and that's exactly maybe the impulse that leads someone to buy a gun, is not wanting to feel like a victim and not wanting to feel like, you know, someone else is sort of controlling what you're doing. I think it's an interesting but problematic comparison.
Well, Amanda was making that argument within a larger argument that says we should feel sympathy for Nancy Lanza, that she was reading all of these, you know, pieces about kind of Nancy Lanza being bracketed aside from the rest of the innocent victims, that her name isn't being read at the memorials and that she's not being included in the—
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's awful.
And so she was making a case that, like, that she is an innocent victim, and that just because these were her guns and just because she owned these guns does not mean that she brought this upon herself, and that, you know, this is something horrible that happened to her too, and we should be mourning her as well.
Yeah, this sounds like an NRA line, and it's a version of it, but I think we've spent a lot of time in digesting this tragedy talking about the means of death rather than, like, the reasons that led him to shoot up that school.
Yeah, I mean, the reasons, the problem, and I wrote about this a little bit, the problem is that the reasons often lead back to a woman. You know, we expect a certain amount of empathy and sympathy from women. And so almost immediately when these killings happen, we find the woman who was closest to him, whether it was his wife or his girlfriend or his mother, and say, like, what the hell was going on there? I mean, I mentioned—
Or they should have known.
They should have known. Like, I mentioned in my— The best insight we have into this phenomenon is the mother of Dylan Klebold, the Columbine killer, wrote a long, wrenching essay in O Magazine. Her name is Susan Klebold. And she described this totally insane feeling you have where you're, you know, you're desperate to hear that it's not your son. Then you hear it's your son. Then you hear that your son is dead. Then you basically spend the next 5 years, everybody looking at you and thinking, who the hell raised this monster? Like, what is with this woman that she raised this monster? And you accept this idea that you raised a monster, but you miss the monster because the monster is your own son. And it's just, you realize what a sort of twisted, impossible situation a lot of these mothers and girlfriends are in, because, you know, you never know. I mean, which Dylan was a child, and she describes, you know, yes, he became sullen, and yes, he was hanging out with this other kid, but she wouldn't have known he was, like, plotting to shoot up a school, you know, which I'm sure would be the case with Nancy Lanza too. She probably knew her son was really difficult and weird and socially awkward and whatever other problems he had, but not anything like what he was hatching inside his head.
Right, because that's the point of love, that you can't believe something like that, you know.
Or you know. I mean, this is separate from, like, having guns in the house with someone who you might suspect is off, but or you do know and there's nothing you can do about it because, I mean, we don't need to talk about this at length at all, but because of the mental health system and because you basically have to have your, depending on age, kid arrested, which is a very hard thing to ask a mother to do.
And I think there have been a lot of good analysis of sort of, you know, slices of rage, like the kind of rage that your typical Asperger's kids had is a sort of uncontrolled rage. It's not a calculating, you know, psychopath kind of rage where you sit and plot murder. So it's, you know, it's hard if you think of your son in one way, you're not necessarily thinking that he's going to behave in this other way. And it's just really confusing. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is the new Judd Apatow movie, This is 40. But before we do that, we want to thank our loyal and regular sponsor, Audible.com. Audible is a leading provider of digital books and other audio entertainment on the internet. They have more than 100,000 audiobooks, and you can listen to them on practically any device, which I do mostly in my car on my iPod for my children. Anyway, they offer a free audiobook of your choice when you sign a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX, not double X, but XX. The book I'm going to recommend today is a book called Look Me in the Eye by John Elder Robison, and it's a wonderful memoir about growing up with Asperger's. There's been a few of them written by adults with Asperger's, but this one is amazing and really interesting for anybody, not just parents of children who are on the autism spectrum. So let's move on to This is 40. This is a new movie by Judd Apatow, which stars his regulars, Leslie Mann and Paul Rudd, as a couple who are experiencing their 40s. In some ways, it's the natural next step in the Judd Apatow body of work, which looks at slice of life as we are living it today. It's fair to say that this movie was roundly panned. People didn't like it, didn't think it had an infrastructure or held together. They thought the story was thin and that Judd Apatow's movies are getting baggier and more introspective and not in a good way, was the general line about this.
Well,
I think it hasn't been reviewed a ton of places yet.
I think that was the Slate review.
Okay, yeah.
Gave it a good review in The New Yorker, a good review in EW. There have been a bunch of positive reviews.
Okay, so it's mixed reviews. How about that? We'll say there was mixed reviews of this movie. I just saw the movie and I really liked it. But
Hannah, get the hell out of here.
Tell us why. Tell us why before we
knock me on the head. First of all, I think the funny moments do a lot for me. I mean, it's like there's something about Mary or the 40-year-old virgin. It's like there's a very particular Apatowian, however you say it, dialogue, which Leslie Mann, who is his real-life wife, is really particularly good at, where you start in a kind of normal conversation about something, and then you are suddenly find yourself in absurd moments, like her conversation in the club with the guy who's hitting on her, where she starts to weirdly sound like Borat, you know? So there's sort of, I feel like that the comedian touch that exists in the Judd Apatow movies really does a lot for me, both the physical comedy and the dialogue comedy that's common to a lot of his movies. And also the portrait of the marriage, especially in the first sort of half hour of the movie, while exaggerated, I could completely relate to. I mean, the sort of love-hate in the marriage, the way in which you could have, you know, successive moments in a long-time married life, which seemed completely opposite to each other, was, I thought, really great. Anyway, go ahead. Okay, take me down. What?
I think I laughed maybe 3 times in the movie. And
only
some
three?
Of that was like sympathy pangs for the people laughing around me. I just didn't think it was funny. It felt like he'd been just walking around his house with a tape recorder for the last 2 years and writing down all of the lines that he found charming in his own children or in his wife. And that's not to say that his life is not charming and interesting, but I think this is what Dana Stevens wrote in her pan in Slate, said it felt like a home movie. And it really did that, you know, some things are more charming when your children say them, right? Like mm-hmm. you just are more inclined to find it special and unique.
No,
and this is what I understand from other parents.
No.
All right. The descent in the corner over here. But, you know, he cast his daughters in this. And so, of course, like, he finds anything they say funny, but they were sort of maybe only so-so child actors, and the dialogue that he'd given them, you know, maybe he wrote it, maybe they wrote it, you know, unwittingly a year ago when they said something funny. But I just found it so unoriginal. It was cliche after cliche about what it is to, you know, sort of get older and wish you weren't getting older, and this is what happens to your body, and this is what happens to your relationship, and your kids are so tough to parent but so cute too, and technology is tough. I don't know, maybe I'm just the wrong audience for it, but it just seemed like he was doing middle age a disservice.
No, I totally agree with you, and I'm the right audience for it. I'm like exactly the audience for it. I could forgive it for not being funny. I agree. It was not funny. I barely laughed. And I could forgive it for kind of being plotless, which in some movies I would applaud, but it was like meandering in the worst way. And because it had nothing, I felt like it had nothing insightful to say about aging, about this stage in your marriage, about parenting. Judd Apatow's last movie, I don't know if you guys saw it, Funny People, which I think pretty much was widely panned, was starring Adam Sandler. I thought worked much better as a smart and very moving take on what it means to grow older, what it means to have regrets, what it means to try to connect with people around you in middle age. It also was not funny all the time.
Nor did it mean to be, right?
Nor did it mean to me, but it was insightful and it was moving, and this was not. And I have to disagree with you totally, Hannah, about Leslie Mann. I mean, I would be fine never seeing her in another movie again. She was fine when he first started casting her in these movies, but I think as a leading lady, at least in this movie, I mean, she just grates and grates on me.
Yeah. So, okay, you bring that up. First of all, the only place I'm going to agree with you guys there is with the children. I thought the children were bad. Like, I don't know what to say. They're not that great actors. The older daughter a little bit better than the younger daughter. But for the most part, whenever they came on the screen, it was very jarring for me. I, like, left the movie. I was like, wait a minute, I'm not in a professional movie here, you know? And then they would get off the screen and I'd be like, oh, okay, I am in a professional movie because there's Paul Rudd and I see his face. And you know,
actually, one of the only times I laughed was, the older one is Maude, right? It was a Maude Apatow scene when she's like really briefly standing in her closet and has like a total freak out clothes fit because none of her clothes.
Wait a minute.
That made me laugh.
You did not find it funny when Debbie, I guess her name is Debbie in the movie, was up in that kid's face in the school, that kid who looked like Tom Petty?
No. That was, no.
Not at all. And
or the Melissa.
It's like, now, like, here's the mammogram scene. Here's the colonoscopy scene. Here's, like, a really shallow fight we're going to have, and we're going to have another one in 10 minutes. Here's our financial problems. Here's the hot girl that works in my boutique. It just, ugh.
So I was trying to think about good movies about middle-aged people because they're, that sounds really condescending. But there have been a ton of awesome movies about, like, middle age. And I think the ones that tend to be more fun are sort of focused on later middle-aged people, right? Like the whole genre of, like, you know, Meryl Streep, like, buys a bakery in California and has an affair with, like, Alec Baldwin. That's doing something different. That's, like, the empty nester. Like,
wait, dude, those people are old. They're not middle-aged.
Middle-aged is an expanding category.
Yeah, I mean, 40 is not really middle-aged anymore because we're all going to live till we're 100.
I think no one wants to be called middle-aged. And actually, this is one of the most embarrassing moments I ever had as an interviewer. I was interviewing Julianne Moore. She was in that Sarah Palin movie last year. And I was trying to, you know, get her talking on the subject of Sarah Palin. And I said, well, you know, you might not have a lot in common with her politically, but you both are middle-aged sex symbols. And she got so offended. And, you know, she's 50 and she is incredibly beautiful. And I didn't think that it would be offensive, but of course it was. No one wants to be called middle-aged, especially when you're like a beautiful Hollywood actress.
Wait a minute. Literally, if you do the math, if she doesn't accept that she's middle-aged, she's going to have to live to be 120, which nobody lives.
At the end of the interview, she came back to it and she was like, you better tell your mother you called me middle-aged. And I was like, gosh, like, she is so offended. And all I wanted to do was ask her about her skincare routine because her skin is so beautiful. Anyway, end of Julianne Moore.
Okay, so I need to go back to the movie one more time. Yeah. You didn't like Leslie Mann. Okay, whatever. Okay, let's talk about Judd Apatow's evolution when it comes to women, right? So he's got the same characters here, the overcontrolling woman in the relationship and the man boy, right? Because Paul Rudd and Paul Rudd's father are both man boys. Like, they don't take responsibility for their lives. He works in a record label and, you know, he spends $30,000 on a neon sign inside the building. Like, he's clearly like a loser and irresponsible.
Which is the Apatow thing.
Which is the Apatow thing, that the men sort of waste the money. They're irresponsible. The wives are the ones who make everything happen, which is actually an explicit theme in this movie, as it is in many of the movies. But the one evolution I thought he made in this movie is that she had a full life. Like, he explored her insecurities and her sex life and her yearnings and desires and her relationship with Megan, the unbelievably foxy Megan Fox. And that's why I felt sympathetic to the Leslie Mann character, because I thought, okay, this is not just like a sort of raving, over-controlling bitch who is a foil for the full, rich emotional life of the man who she's with. She actually has an emotional life of her own. And that's good.
If I had bought any of that, maybe then I would be nodding in agreement. But I didn't sort of, I don't know, the stuff about her, you know, needing to lie about her age or the way she related to Megan Fox. None of that felt very honest to me.
What was her inner life other than being worried about not being hot anymore?
Right.
Which she was, by the way. She looked great.
That's the other problem. She looked pretty damn good. Like when she kept saying, you want to do sex with me, she was actually much better looking than the guy who was hitting on her in the club, even though he was younger. Like she was a super total hottie. So it didn't really ring that true.
That's a good question, Nori. What was her inner life?
Unclear. You know, she cared about her kids a lot, but I just didn't think she was as developed of a character. You know, even in the musical tastes he ascribed to her, like she liked, you know, sort of fun dance pop, right? Which is not the sort of introspective, I have feelings, like hardcore, you know, folk rock that her husband got to be really into. And that was just a sort of like throwaway plot line. But, you know,
the music in this movie was also such a problem. I mean, music that I like, you know, generally like, but it just made everything feel even more cliche to have like Fiona Apple and Ryan Adams end up the, it just. Oh.
So you think, but
I'm just picturing Judd Apatow like picking out his music while he's wearing the sneakers that, you know, David Plotz wears.
Right.
Can I
tell David Plotz you said that he has to stop wearing the sneakers of a 19-year-old dude in Brooklyn, that he's got to wear some freaking Oxford shoes like a grown man? Damn it.
I didn't really think that I'm wearing sneakers right now, but I just don't want it for my movies.
Okay, so the knock on Judd Apatow, right, is that all of his movies are sort of about arrested development, right?
Yeah.
Which is why this should have been an interesting thing, because early middle age for many people seems to be about sort of arrested development. And that's what this movie was about. People who were getting older didn't want to be getting older. And that's a really interesting phenomenon. But he just went to cliche after cliche, you know, and there has to be something new to say about that, right? Because it's a different thing to be 40 now than it was 10 or 20 years ago in some ways. But he just went the easy route. He went like, isn't it crazy that my kids watch Lost on their iPad? Like, whoa, that's annoying. And then we argue about Mad Men versus Lost. And that's a new phenomenon. But that's just sort of a shallow surface level reading of
but
something
look,
that
Bridesmaids didn't bring up any original situations. It's
I
just...
didn't love Bridesmaids.
Oh.
Bridesmaids was overhyped. I thought it was good, but I've seen like 3 movies since then that are funnier, like girl cast comedies. Maybe one.
Man.
That was the one we talked about.
Your bar is too high.
The Bachelorette.
Yeah.
Also, I think, you know, the subtext of what's so horrible about becoming middle-aged is your impending doom and death. And that's, I think, why Funny People also worked better. I mean, that was overt. That was not subtext. And, you know, the Adam Sandler character is dying or thinks he's dying. And not that I think, like, someone should have had cancer in this movie and that would have made it better. I don't think that at all. But
I did have a moment when the Paul Rudd character is biking, you know, very dangerously. I was like, maybe they're going to kill him off. That'll be interesting. Because I'd read the Slate review and there was like, there's a third act twist. And I was like, maybe that's it. That'd be a more interesting
That bike
movie.
Scene also is like ripped from 4-year-old Virgin. I don't get it.
Okay. What about give me Melissa McCarthy in the principal's office? Even that. She's the mother of the Tom Petty boy. You know, she's from Bridesmaids.
Yeah, she was funny. This is what I'll give you. The stuff about Paul Rudd hiding in the bathroom, taking a shit so he can escape his family. I found that to be funny.
You mean while he was playing whatever game he was playing on his iPad?
First of all, I think Judd Apatow seems to be a really good like producer and director, but not a great writer. Maybe that's a lesson that we've learned from his last few movies. But he reaches for the scatological so much and the sort of like, let me say fuck as many times as possible and see if it's funny. And even in the Melissa McCarthy scene, that was sort of where the like heat of the humor was coming from, that she was just saying fuck in a really, you know, unexpected and inappropriate place. And I'm sort of like no
over
longer
it.
Shocked. And it's not that I don't think that like swearing is funny, but you know, I've been watching like a lot of Armando Iannucci stuff, and that's fucking funny humor because he uses it like in so many new creative ways. And I just feel like Judd Apatow is going to the same well over and over again. And the sort of, you know, scatological, sweary humor that felt really fresh and new maybe 7 years ago when we were all first in trance with him is kind of feeling tired. I don't know.
I feel like you guys, your bar is too high, your dark side is too close to the surface, and you just can't relax, and it's a freaking holiday week, and just chill out and laugh a little bit. That's how I feel about this situation.
All right.
Onward.
Talking about The Thick of It.
The Thick of It, yeah. I've been...
Rent it.
It's amazing. I think I've recommended it on here.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, onwards. We are now going to talk about a story which was called by Ethan Hauser in the New York Times recently, which calls the total agony of family time. Hauser is not bringing up anything that we haven't thought about during these holiday seasons or every holiday seasons of our life, which is you're supposed to be having fun, you're supposed to be seeing your family, you're supposed to be relaxing, but instead there is an element of agony to the scene. I'm just going to read a scene at Penn Station that he describes. At Penn Station, everyone gets on with too many bags, all those meticulously wrapped presents, all the desperate sons and daughters-in-law trying to impress intractable tribal New England parents. Give up, I want to tell them. That electric pepper mill and unfortunate sweater won't melt a heart hardened by a thousand winters. Grab a beer and stay on this train until it hits Canada. Border crossings always bring a measure of relief. Now, my holidays involve lots of Jews, not lots of waspy New England chilly parents. And so that was not especially the part of the essay that I related to. I related more to the regressing into a petulant teenager phenomenon, which amazingly, though I am 40, I really can just so fast do the instant I see my mother's face. So, Allison, your husband's written about, you know, how to properly fight with your family. Kind of is there like a method to this, Matt? Are we just doomed every single time to, you know, repeat these eternal human patterns?
To a certain extent, yes. I think we all regress when we go home. And many of our mothers encourage this by wanting to cook for us and wanting to do for us. But no, I don't know. I found this essay to be incredibly yuck. I didn't like it at all. I mean, I didn't like him. I thought he was kind of hateful. I felt bad for his parents. I don't feel this way when I go home. There's a difference between going home to your parents and going home to your in-laws, which is what I'm about to do. Not that I don't love my in-laws, but there is a difference.
Because you can't regress and because your
obligation. Because you can't regress. Uh-huh. Yeah. And, you know, there's good and bad in that because you also can't, like, just totally lay back and take off your bra and walk around in your pajamas all day. sorry.
You should.
I'm very pregnant.
Listen, this is how I live. This is how I live, my mother-in-law, okay? Accept me or don't.
I'm not bringing you the pepper mill. I'm taking off my bra.
For your in-laws, do you know what to buy them? Like, have you figured
God,
out?
God, no. But we just asked them.
Oh. That's nice.
Have you figured out a system of being with your in-laws that works for you?
Yes, I have. And I love my in-laws.
Yeah, so it's not that hard. I actually need to read the part of the essay that I really, really did relate to. On one of my recent visits home, I misremembered the time of my train back to New York. I got it wrong by an hour or so. The train was later than I had thought. It was an honest mistake, I swear. When my mother accompanying me, her adult son, into the station saw the snafu, she said, "But what will you do until then?" Which is exactly what my mother would say. "It's fine. I'll kill time in the bar down the street," which is not really what I would say. I would, like, kill time in the Amtrak waiting station doing some work or whatever. "I could wait, too," she said. Translation, please God, no. And she hugged me goodbye and drove back to the house.
This is me approaching 40, but I said this to Noreen earlier. I sympathize with the parents in that situation because I do this kind of thing to my kids already.
Okay, how
probe
old
them,
are you?
Ask them questions. Don't, you know, I mean, I get it. They're desperate for time with us.
Well, so this is...
And we're lucky if they are desperate for time with us.
This is the thing I was trying to think about because I do the regression to teenage years.
Do you all go home, Noreen? All your sisters?
We all go home and it's so fun. I have 5 siblings and we all go home and now they're like, you know, in-laws and children and it's just, it's really fun. It's like a Christmas postcard. But we get in fights, right? You know, because we are all in the same place and everyone looks forward to it so much that there's, you know, anticipation. And so if everything isn't perfect, people get a little upset. You know, if you only see the people you love like for 1 or 2 weeks a year, you feel like you can't go in your room and read a book, right? And maybe you're the kind of person who needs that decompression time. So instead, you're sitting in the family room sort of talking to the same people that you've been talking to for, you know, 300 straight hours. And there's a point where, you know, old scars open up and, you know, you act like you're 17. So I've been trying to think about ways to not do that because I feel like for me, Thanksgiving, I was particularly teenage and I've been trying to, you know.
Strategies.
So do you guys have strategies?
I have strategies and they fail me every time. I think a lot of my issues lately have more to do with my, you know, new family than my old family, except this one issue of the way I behave when my mother gives me a present. And every time my mother's about to give me a present, I say to myself, "Don't do that, Hannah. You have a strategy here. Your strategy is to say, 'Thank you, you idiot,' and just like open the present and be happy with it." And I just am horrible. Like, I cannot explain what comes over me when my mother gives me or my children a present. present and I behave the way that I do.
You mean because you never like it?
It doesn't matter if I like it. I'm just horrible about it. Like, I complain about it, or I'm annoyed with her, or I'm
even
annoyed.
If you
with
like it.
It's weird. Yeah. Even if I like it, it's like,
it does seem-
I really hope if any of our listeners are therapists, I'm sure that this is a phenomenon. That's something
it's
that
like
the
you don't
metaphor,
want anything from her. Like,
well,
don't.
I
don't.
Resent something from the past about it's like it's such an obvious fucking metaphor. It's like, you know, the things she did or didn't give me, it's like all sort of there in that gift. And it's the last remaining deep. I mean, it's not that I'm not irrational, but like the way in which anybody who looked at this situation from the outside would not blame my mother and be like, what is wrong with that lady talking about me? And I still can't help it. I can't stop doing it.
I wonder if it's maybe I'm putting my own stuff on it here, but I wonder if it's when someone gives you a present, they're saying, this is something that I think would be useful in your life. Like, this is something I think you would like. So there, it's like an implicit judgment about what your life looks like, or maybe what it should look like. And maybe, you know, you're thinking a little bit about that. Like, why does she think I would like this, even if it's something you do like?
Maybe also there's something kind of positive and beautiful about us being able to be our most horrible selves around our families. We go through life kind of, you know, trying to put on a good face in many scenarios or trying to project a certain image. And I, for one, am happy that I can just go home and, you know, sometimes be an asshole or, like I said, take off my whatever. Just like, this is – you're not putting on anything because – and sometimes you have to for your in-laws, but it's particularly like with your own family. You're just not. And that's a relief, even if in the moment it's mean and horrible.
Totally. You can only really fight with the people you really love because they'll forgive you. So maybe it's just that I save up all my fighting for these 2 weeks a year.
It's
got to come out.
You know, I kind of understand that about my daughter. Like, I don't give her a lot of grief. She's becoming a teenager and she's really mean to me sometimes. And I kind of understand that she's mean to me because she can be mean to me. And she walks around her day probably desiring to be mean to lots of people, and she just can't do that, you know, because you're in your social construct. So I kind of get it with her. I don't get mad at her, but I'm not really able to get it around myself. Although I will say one of the most poignant memories of my whole life, we used to go back to Israel a lot because my family's from Israel, and we used to go visit my grandmother, my mother's mother there. And one of my most poignant memories, and I probably my mother did this every time we went to Israel, but I only noticed it when I was about 15 or 16, was the way that my mother behaved around her mother suddenly occurred to me when I was a teenager was unlike the way my mother behaved around anybody else. Like, her body language was different, the way she sat on the couch. Like, it was like watching my mother sort of take on the body of a teenager. And I distinctly remember her kind of lying down on the couch. So my mother's very neat, and you know, she was my mother. So around me, she behaved like in the motherly role. And then suddenly she, I guess what she was doing was regressing. I just have a really clear memory of what she looked like lying on the couch. So yes, there is that beautiful thing where you only get to be that way with one person.
Our parents' generation related to their parents in a much different way than we do to ours or than our kids do to us. I think, you know, with each generation, there's some kind of like breakdown of maybe respect right. and decorum. But with that comes like a lot of honesty.
Yeah, I think that's a totally good point. There wasn't a lot of honesty between our parents and their parents. And I think maybe that's also where some of the fights come from sometimes is, you know, our parents just want to know everything about our lives, and sometimes that can feel difficult to share.
Okay, we halfway workshopped.
We hope everyone is enjoying their holidays as they're listening.
Yes, and that we have put a different spin on this for you so that whatever fight you just had with your mom, dad, sister, brother 1 minute ago, you now realize as a symptom of love and not hate. That's where we'll end it. Okay, let's go to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first this time?
I discovered this week that the soundtrack to Nashville is available on Spotify and for purchase on iTunes. And it's great. If you've been watching and loving Nashville, which I think we've talked about a little bit before, you've probably been loving and listening to the music. You know, the songs are really good. Connie Britton's voice is, okay. But overall, it's a fun listen.
Is the duet prominent in the CD the way it is in the...
The duet is great. The duet is just wonderful.
I don't watch this show, guys. Everybody loves it, huh?
Oh, you have to watch it. You have to watch it.
It's not deep. You really should watch it. I mean, you should bring it with you if you can find the season on DVD somewhere and bring it with you on vacation. It's like totally easy to watch. It's not like Homeland or anything, you know?
Yeah, it's a soap opera.
Yeah.
That's a soap opera.
Yeah.
I'm not, what do you think I am?
Well, clearly you're someone who needs like darkness and intensity. Okay. I'm going to just mention the books that I have brought with me and I'm enjoying on my vacation. One was actually recommended by Katie Royfe based on a column she wrote, and it's the Rebecca West, The New Meaning of Treason, particularly an essay on a murder trial, which is great. And the second is Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth, which I actually haven't cracked yet, but I'm very much looking forward to reading and will relate to you all what I think of it next time. Allison, what about you?
In the spirit of family togetherness and family reunions, I'm going to recommend checking out this woman. This was featured on Slate's Behold blog, this Helsinki-based photographer named Wilma Herksanian, who has made an obsession and a project into getting her sisters and occasionally her parents back together again to recreate old family photos. You know, she puts them side by side, a photo of them all, you know, posed in front of some statue on family vacation, and then they pose now. There's one of all of the siblings in the bathtub naked and one of them now in the bathtub naked, and I've spent a lot of time thinking about which family photos my parents and my sister and I should recreate, although all of my suggestions to them over email have gotten rebuffed because nobody wants to do this except for me.
I think you should do it and post it on the Facebook page.
It made me think. I was like, what about that picture when we were little and we were in the bathtub with Dad? And my sister was like, no. We had a very loose nudity policy, I think, in my house.
Yeah, but it's not so loose that you're going to recreate that photo.
Well,
now.
Not now. No, I don't really
I think know. Everyone has.
I think my dad would probably wear something.
Yeah. I also think everyone has those bathtub pictures, you know, buried somewhere.
Yeah. We might have been a little old.
All right. Well, we won't unpack that one. That's the real therapy session.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us. Thank you to our listeners for listening today, and happy holidays to all of you. I'd like to also thank Abdullah Rufus for engineering this podcast and Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. Please come on our XX Facebook page and tell us what you liked or didn't like and what you think we should discuss in upcoming podcasts. For Noreen Malone and Allison Benedict, I am Hannah Rosen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.